All right, since this is a little taped audio shtick, what I usually say is, and the big show continues, it's Vivian Campbell from Def Leppard. How you doing?
I'm great. Thank you very much.
I got to say, this is the Def Leppard album I've been waiting for about 10 years.
You and me both, you know. I've been with the band 10 years, exactly, and this is only my third studio album with the band. I mean, in between we did the Retroactive record, which was all the B-sides and whatnot, and the Greatest Hits record. And this is far and away the best of the studio records that I've made with the band. Mm-hmm. It's the only one that I could truly, truly feel happy with. And I think that feeling is universal amongst the other guys in the band. We're stoked with it. It was exactly what we wanted, you know. And it was an easy record to make too. It was a lot easier than the past couple of records mm-hmm. from the '90s. It just went very, very smoothly. And that smoothness is also went through to the video. It was the easiest video we've ever made, and I think one of the best that the band has made, certainly in a long time.
I like the concept of it.
Yeah, the concept, you know, we were sold on it as soon as we saw it. We got 5 or 6 or 7 submissions from different directors, and that one stood out head and shoulders above the rest. It was directed by a couple of guys called the Malloys, and we just loved the concept, and it worked so perfect. I mean, resurrecting the icon from the band's past, you know, but yet bringing it all the way through to 2002, you know, and the title of the song being Now. You know, and we are wanting to represent the Def Leppard in 2002, and the way the band sounds, we think we still have a current sound. Although we're very proud, obviously, of what the band's history is, so it brings to play all those things.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and we've made it to the end of 2 months of Def Leppard talk. This is going to be the final episode about Def Leppard, just kind of wrap up the career of the band. We've gone album by album, just really focused on their catalog here, and I've had a lot of fun doing it. And the best part about this idea was to have a different guest co-host for each episode, and pretty much all just fellow podcasters. I love this whole network of rock podcasters that I've got going here. It's a lot of fun. And so for this episode, I'm joined by John Lamoureux. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You got it.
Yeah. John Lamoureux hosts a podcast called The Hustle. And the way I discovered your show is very funny. One of my best friends of 20 plus years now, Chris, and he's been on the podcast a couple times, actually, the Soul Asylum and Goo Goo Dolls episodes. And one day he tells me I should check out his brother-in-law's podcast. And so I take a look and I see Paul Collins, Jeff Murphy, and I write back to Chris. I'm like, how can it have taken you this long to tell me about this? So not only are you a fellow rock podcaster, but your sister is married to maybe the only person I know who rivals myself in terms of being an obsessed music fan, which I'm sure you're very familiar with.
Yes, it makes Christmases and other holidays very interesting. On the one hand, I have someone to talk to. On the other hand, I have someone who, with so much knowledge, it's kind of overwhelming to take in at one time.
Yeah, he's out there in the world, he's the closest person I know to me in terms of taste. And he's got a very similar record collection, pretty much about the same size as mine, and a lot of...
I've always wondered who was influencing who.
Both, like, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, when we first met in college, you know, we just bonded over all these different bands that we both liked that we didn't know anybody else who liked. It was that kind of a thing, you know?
Yeah.
And then, of course, both of us have turned each other on to tons of stuff over the years. I mean, you know... I'm sure you're very familiar with Chris's love of Ginger and the Wild Hearts.
Of course.
And, I'm the person who gave him a Wild Hearts mixtape that, started that whole thing rolling. So,
yep. Right on.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, when I first met Chris, I think he was wearing a Cheap Trick jacket, and
right
you know,
on.
Cool. So it's funny that you know he's like, yeah, you should check out my brother-in-law's podcast, and I'm like, wow, you know, it's a small world, I guess.
It is, but, it is. Nice. Yeah. I love him. Good. I'm glad this happened.
Yeah, so your show, The Hustle, I mean, I love the idea behind your show, which is that you want to talk to the people who are kind of on the periphery of rock history, who maybe had a certain level of success and then just kind of disappeared, and just find out what they did for the rest of their lives, which to someone like me is absolutely fascinating. So I love the whole concept of your show.
Yeah, good. Thank you. Yeah, that's the idea. I just, for years, I would get so obsessed and curious about where do people go. And then how, and this sounds indelicate, I don't mean for it to, but how do they pay their bills for the rest of their lives? If they had a song that was a hit, even a moderate hit in like 1981, does that, how do you live the rest of your life? Do you make enough money off that? Do you license it? Or do you go get a regular job? And I just think those kinds of stories, they don't get told, and they're fascinating, you know? So I set out to do it, and luckily people keep talking to me. You tell someone you have a podcast and they'll talk to you. It's fascinating, even though I'm a nobody, you know?
Yeah, it is crazy that anyone can have a podcast. And yeah, you know, I write to someone like Chips Enough and then he talks to me. And, it, you know, I'm really not much more than just any random person that he could call him on the phone just because I say, hey, I have a podcast.
I know.
Well, what does that mean?
Right.
So, yeah. Yeah.
I know, it's nuts. I figure on the one hand, the bigger names, like I had Ranking Roger on recently, and that one took months to line up and finally happened. And he's used to doing a lot of media, and I'm just one more thing. And he probably doesn't even feel any kind of connection with me. He just does it out of habit because he's been doing it for 35, 40 years. But then there's those people who are shocked that you even want to talk to them, you know? They've moved on. They aren't doing interviews anymore, and they're probably grateful that you found them. You know, I like to think that way anyway. So hopefully I'm sort of, I want to validate their, what they've put in this world. I want them to know that what they did mattered. Even if it's been 30, 40 years, I want them to know that there's somebody out there who cares about what they did, and maybe they don't get told that often enough. So I'm going to tell them. I want them to know. And honor them. It's kind of a, I don't know, maybe it's like a mission. I'm not sure, but it's been a lot of fun. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. For example, your episode with the guy from the Monroes. I mean, how awesome was that? He was so nice and had such a great story. And, you know, this is a band that had one minor hit, very minor hit, which I just love that song. They only, all they ever had was that one EP. And and you know, it's the same with my show. We're aiming for a limited audience here. I mean, that's a given from the start. There's not that many people that are going to be interested in the Monroes, but for someone like me, I love it.
Well, and it's funny you factored into that one even happening, and it's interesting because so he and I are friends. Tony Ortiz, great guy. He and I are friends on Facebook, and he's looking for a job. And a couple of different times, he's posted on Facebook, "Hey, friends. I'm looking for a job. If anyone has any, you know, openings, let me know and I'll send you my resume. I'm willing to relocate." That stuff that we've all been through, that it's so sad. And here's a guy who sang this great song and at one time performed in front of 20,000 people in 1981 or whatever. And now he's looking for a job just like the rest of us, you know, he's a regular guy. And it's just, you don't hear those stories. I find them really endearing. Especially when they're from good people like him. So,
yeah, that is such a great song. What Do All the People Know? Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously everyone listening should definitely check out The Hustle, which is on iTunes, and you're on Podbean now. Do you have a website, or is it just your Podbean website?
It's thehustle.podbean.com. I don't even know how or have the time to make a full website, so I just use the Podbean to host and post the episodes. So if people, whatever doesn't show up in iTunes, it's probably older, and they could go to thehustle.podbean.com and find it on there.
Right. Yeah, and I'll have links with this episode too.
Oh, cool. So. Thank you.
So I guess our project today is to talk about the rest I've been trying to think of what I'm going to call this episode. I was actually researching to see if there's a word for what comes after euphoria, but I couldn't find it. I was like, there's got to be a word, like a, you know, an actual term for like the you know, whatever you would call it, like post euphoria. Maybe I'll call the episode post euphoria. But yeah, I was hoping there was some kind of a word.
I keep thinking how honored I am to be the guy that you chose to talk about the Def Leppard albums that no one listens to. I was especially honored for that.
So, yeah, thank you. Yeah. Thanks a lot. Yeah, you get the leftovers, right?
That's okay. They're really good, and I've been pouring over them to prepare for this conversation, but I'll be honest, who knows when I'll ever pull out X again, you know? It might be a while.
Yeah, well, 10. you were the one person that actually said you liked these records. I don't know if anyone else even professed to like them. I'm not sure.
I have an open mind. So yeah, there's good stuff on each one, you know? I don't hate any of them.
So what is your story as a Def Leppard fan, then?
Yeah, So here's the deal. Growing up, and I've been thinking a lot about this, and maybe you can relate. So growing up, I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah. I grew up Mormon. Everyone else is mostly Mormon. I shunned or kind of pushed away, we'll call it hair metal, during the 80s for most of my life. And I realized recently the reason why is because, you know, when you're in school, the kids who are really into that were the stoners. We called them stoners, right? And they were the kids with the long hair and the jean jackets, and they looked a little grubby. And maybe they were lower on the socioeconomic scale, and maybe they came from broken homes. These are all the things you're projecting on kids who are labeled stoners. Even the term stoner implies getting stoned, doing drugs, sinning, some kind of carnal activity, right? And I was a kid with like hair gel and my shirt buttoned up to the top and my pants pegged, you know, and listening to Howard Jones or whatever. And so even though I'm seeing, you know, Whitesnake and Def Leppard and whatever, Cinderella on MTV, and I'm digging some of those songs, I can't bring myself to actually buy albums or invest or participate in that world because that wasn't how I saw myself, you know? That wasn't what I was aspiring to. Now, keep in mind, I regret that any of this is true, but that's what it was as a teenager growing up in Salt Lake City. So finally, about 10 years ago, I read Chuck Klosterman's Fargo Rock City, that book. I don't know if you've read it or not, but it's basically this defense of the artistic merit of hard rock and heavy metal, specifically the 80s. And that had a profound effect on me. And one of the main reasons, one of the main takeaways I got from it was that the people who like that music are not sinners and devilish and drug addicts and bad people. It's usually very good people, regular working class, blue collar folks who just want to have fun, and the music is meant to be fun. And I had never categorized the music in that way before. And so suddenly when I can refocus my perception of this music, it becomes a lot more inviting. It's not the scary thing that it was when I was a kid. And so I go nuts at the time. You know, it was a lot of downloading and it was a lot of collecting all that heavy metal that I had pushed away growing up. Around the same time, that two-disc Def Leppard Greatest Hits, what is it, Rock of Ages, came out.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget it. My sister gave me the Footloose soundtrack for my birthday. She knows I like 80s music. She thought that would be funny. I went to Target. I wanted to switch it out. I wasn't in the mood for Footloose. And I saw Rock of Ages there. And I thought, you know, I don't have any Def Leppard in my collection. It's time that I start investing. And so I switched it for Rock of Ages. And I loved it. And it finally occurred to me, Def Leppard are a great rock and roll band. And they are steeped in the bands that I love and that I felt that I've always loved. David Bowie, Queen, those aren't scary heavy metal bands, which I don't think are scary anymore. They're incredible artists, and that's who their influences are. And so suddenly Def Leppard becomes this amazing band that I had just not been paying enough attention to most of my life. And so since then, I love them. That's why I'm open to even talking about these latter day albums, because there's good stuff in all of them. These guys provide a service to this world by putting out excellent music. Even some of it sounds the same, or it doesn't always grow, or it's not always right on, but they're out there doing it. They're elder statesmen of this kind of sound, and I'm so grateful for that now. So that's my Def Leppard story.
The 80s was so weird because nobody thought that Stephen King was a murderer. Nobody thought that the people that wrote and directed Friday the 13th were actually murderers. But if you were in a band and you wrote a song, then you were, you know, people couldn't disconnect the creativity and the art. I mean, Slayer were a horror band, just like Friday the 13th was a horror movie, you know. Yeah. But people, for some reason, in the 80s especially, people couldn't make that connection, even though they could do it with Stephen King or, you know, Tobe Hooper or whatever, but they just couldn't. With Ozzy Osbourne, they couldn't. Ozzy was a Satanist and evil, and, you know, now in retrospect, it makes no sense. It just seems ridiculous. The whole PMRC hearings just seem like a complete farce now.
Totally, totally.
So, yeah, it's, but, you know, I completely remember the time where it was all so dangerous, you know.
It was. You mentioned Ozzy. I remember loving Bark at the Moon as a kid, but then feeling so frightened that I wasn't supposed to. And is this going to corrupt me? And what does it say about me that I like an Ozzy Osbourne song when I really shouldn't? And I don't even remember him. I think he was on Solid Gold playing that song. And I thought, oh, I like this song, but I'm really wrestling with whether I should. It was that kind of a thing until I finally grew out of it and grew to just appreciate all kinds of music from wherever and whenever, you know. I finally got over it.
But obviously, for a lot of people, that whole dynamic was a huge selling point.
Yeah, you know, of course.
I'm not supposed to have this. I'm not supposed to listen to it. So I think the bands also kind of milked it at times in the record labels. Totally. So you had, it was just very strange, the whole thing.
Yep.
But so I thought I would just go through kind of an overview of the whole Def Leppard history here that I wrote up. Since we've made it to the final episode in the series, I thought I would just do like a quick summary of their catalog. I mean, we started with the first album, On Through the Night, which was a solid album made by really ambitious teenagers. It made it clear that this young band had a lot of potential, and it's a very good rock album, but also it was kind of safe, and their influences kind of really bled through on it. So it wasn't quite clear yet who exactly Def Leppard were, but they made it clear on the next album, High and Dry, because that's a very cocky, confident album, in my opinion, kind of perfectly produced by Mutt Lang, and they very quickly had discovered themselves, came into their own on that second album. I look at High and Dry sort of like a time capsule of a young band just nailing it. Just they realized their full potential to me. And with High and Dry, I'd say there's just enough Mutt Lang, like just the right amount of Mutt Lang. But the next album, Pyromania, I think we start getting a little bit too much Mutt Lang.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I love the record, but I don't know. There's a little, the production I have issues with. I think High and Dry, the production is just amazing. But Pyromania is still a great album. But the way High and Dry was kind of an organic thing, a really confident record.
Uh-huh.
I think Pyromania, they sort of replaced that confidence with just setting the goal so high that it was almost unattainable. Like,
but they did attain it. That's
album. Exactly. They did. You did attain it, right?
I mean, they set the sights high, and then they did it. That's I think people like Eddie Trunk agree more with you. Like the older, less glossy, I guess we could say, sound is more to their liking. But I don't know. I just feel like they nailed it on some of those.
Well, I think High and Dry feels like they were making a record for themselves. Like they were making the record they wanted to make that they would like. And Pyromania feels like they're trying to make a record everyone will like. You know, they want to conquer the world. And so it's kind of a different motivation. But yeah, like you said, they achieved the goal. Pyromania did conquer the world. Also, the idea that Pete Willis was replaced with Phil Collins means the whole chemistry of the band kind of changed. It was in flux as they were finishing Pyromania, and then the chemistry of the band is further altered between Pyromania and Hysteria when their drummer loses an arm. So you got a one-armed drummer, that's not going to be the same band anymore.
right
So Hysteria, it weirdly becomes like an overcoming adversity album. Yeah, I mean, they're following up this huge success, so you wouldn't think they'd be in that position. But then somehow they end up in this position where they're overcoming adversity, and they make multiple attempts with multiple producers. And Hysteria, we get way too much Mutt Lange, in my opinion.
It's not my favorite either. There's a couple, you know, the songs I love on that album are like Woman and Animal. Rocket might be my favorite Def Leppard song overall. Probably just because they name check all, you know, Bowie and all those guys. But I feel like if you're making good art, even if it's, you know, I don't want to sidetrack you too much, but like, for instance, you know, Max Martin is that Swedish pop song scientist.
Yeah.
And he writes a song on X or 10 or whatever we're calling it. So clearly they have those kind of ambitions. I just feel like, and I appreciate that if you can nail it, and I feel like they nailed it. So I respect the effort that went into, we're going to give you something that it should be difficult not to like. And they did. So I respect that kind of artistry. That is artistry to me, just as difficult music or stripped down music or heavier music is also artistry, but I might be different that way.
Yeah, well, I like Hysteria too, and I agree, I respect the artistry, but Hysteria is an exercise in perfectionism, which isn't necessarily a good thing. I think perfectionism is very different from like the balls and the swagger of High and Dry. So, you know, Hysteria and High and Dry really basically have nothing to do with each other. It doesn't even seem like they were made by the same band.
Good point.
Hysteria is kind of polished beyond recognition, almost, you know. Pyromania, and if you think about it, Pyromania is way closer to High and Dry than it is to Hysteria. So Hysteria was kind of a big leap, just very different in pretty much every way from what they had done previously.
Well, do you see it as... I see it as a progression. I mean, I see especially those first four... The first five albums technically could just be viewed as a progression. We're just going to keep taking this bigger and bigger, and then by Adrenalize, it just imploded from hubris. Basically, I mean, we're going to keep trying, keep pushing, keep making this thing grow and progress, but it has to end somewhere, and it ended basically by Adrenalize. That's my feeling. I don't know.
Well, I think maybe rather than progression, I would call Hysteria a mutation.
Oh, okay.
And then comes Adrenalize, which, like you said, well, first they have more tragedy with the loss of Steve Clark, and then, so now the band that made High and Dry just no longer exists at all, and Adrenalize, this time there's not enough Mutt Lange, which is funny, and, you know... Whereas with Hysteria, it was too much polish and just, like, overthinking it. Adrenalize seems half-assed and unfinished, and, like, they're just kind of taking their fans for granted. And it was... But also, you know, you have to think, you know, they lost Steve Clark and, you know, everything that went into that. But in the end, Adrenalize is just kind of misguided and clueless, especially considering the timing of its release, because Nevermind was at the top of the charts... Right. When Adrenalize came out, so it was really bad timing.
Yeah, it was.
It was not the best time to put out a half-assed kind of, you know, just here. I guess we got to put this out now.
Right.
You know.
And they had become very clearly the other, you know, whereas before Nirvana was the other. Nirvana had come and overwhelmed their position, and now they were coming in as the other and would basically remain that way from then on.
So Adrenalize failed on pretty much every level, and that brought us to the identity crisis of Slang, which was their attempt at kind of adapting to the 90s, and it was a much more of a creative effort, and in my opinion, a creative success than Adrenalize, but they had very different goals. I think they achieved their creative goals. I like that record, but it failed in pretty much every other way, and there was no recognition or attention. It, you know, it didn't sell. And it just failed to translate to the audience. You know, if you take a cynical view, they were trying to make an alternative record, but at least, like I said on the earlier episodes, at least they didn't try to make a grunge album. They just kind of tried to make it more artsy and serious, which was one approach that some of the 80s bands took in the 90s, was just kind of change the lyrical themes and incorporate some kind of weird rhythms and
I'm embarrassed to say I've never listened to Slang the whole way through.
I like it. It's way better than Adrenalize, that's for sure. It has some great songs. The single Work It Out is a great song. Gift of Flesh is great. There's some really good stuff on there. There's some bad stuff too, but in any event, they compromised. It didn't work. Obviously, what they did with Euphoria is they tried to pretend. Not only did they try to pretend Slang never happened, I think they tried to pretend Adrenalize never happened. And now they're saying we're going to complete the trilogy. You know, Pyromania, right. Hysteria, Euphoria. But the problem with that was, one, it was too late.
Right.
Two, it's not really cohesive. It's kind of a schizophrenic album because I think there was... I don't think they all agreed on what direction they wanted to go in. So in the end, most of the record seems like they're trying to recapture past glories. But then some of the songs don't fit at all because they were still trying to... I don't know, have something that might feel more contemporary to 1999. So you have some songs on there that don't seem to fit, and then they're put in really prominent places on the record, so it really disrupts the flow. So if they were trying to make an album that, you know, recaptured Pyromania and Hysteria, it didn't work because I don't think they were all on the same page, and so then there's a couple of songs in there that should just be completely jettisoned.
See, I have a hard time even... first of all, I should say I love Promises. I think that's one of their strongest singles ever. But the rest of the album is just noise to me. And it's... I'm thinking as you're talking about it, what's occurring to me is that it almost sounds like them trying to do or being influenced by a little bit of Nine Inch Nails, which makes sense because that's big at the time. But it's just... It's so... soulless and overthought and over the top. There isn't an honest moment, I don't think, hardly on that album. Now, having said all that, it's still maybe a 5 out of 10 for me. I mean, I can't hate anything by Def Leppard, but that album is just frustratingly overworked, overcooked, and slick to me, and I can't get into it. It kind of hurts me. It depresses me to listen to that.
Well, what you get is, I think it's the third song and the fifth song are the two by far worst songs on the record. And you get those at spots 3 and 5. And then when you get to the end of the record, like the last two songs on the record are the heaviest songs that would most resemble maybe like a Pyromania. And they're all tacked onto the end as if maybe at some point they were thinking about making a record like those songs, but then they changed their mind and then they just tack them on the end. So... Yeah, it seems like they weren't quite sure what they were doing, and so it doesn't come together as an album, but there are some pretty good songs on it.
Yeah, I would agree.
So that brings us to now, to what album number 8 would... Well, I mean, they called it X, I guess saying it's their 10th album, but it's their 8th studio album.
Right.
I guess they're counting Retroactive and I guess what the greatest hits or something.
I think so. Yeah, Vault. But, is that what it is? Yeah.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask you what you think of what I was thinking about, which is, you know, when you get to Def Leppard in 2002, thinking about what a rock band is, should there even be a Def Leppard in 2002? Because isn't rock and roll about the youthful energy? I mean, if you go back to High and Dry and look at the band that made that record, well, 20 years later, there's just nothing left of that, right? Is a rock and roll band supposed to last this long? Or does it at some point just become like... I don't know what a word would be to describe it. I don't want to be too mean.
But, like a nostalgia act, basically?
Well, not even that. Well, should it even exist? I mean, what a rock band is supposed to be, doesn't there come a point where... of course, with something like Def Leppard, it turns into... First it becomes a job, then it becomes a business, then it's a trademark and it's a corporation. And the end...
Right.
So what is a rock and roll band? And when it becomes a 40-year-old corporation, is there anything left of what a rock and roll band in essence is, you know?
I would say yes. Now, it depends on what kind of gradation you're going for here. Are you rock and roll, the truest rock and roll in the sense that you're talking about? I think you're talking about youth and vitality and rebellion and bursts of creativity and learning DIY, learning how to play your instruments. That moment is so short for a band. And if you want to keep the true spirit of rock and roll, which I guess is what that is, then yeah, bands become past their prime very quickly. I mean, your beloved Cheap Trick, who I love as well, they continue to make good music, but have they been vital since, you know, the late 70s or so? Maybe not. But you would never in a million years would you want Cheap Trick to ever stop doing what they do best. And even if it's just serving those people who love them so devoutly, then bless them for that, you know? So Def Leppard, I'm sure see themselves as artists. I would assume every time they put out an album, number one, yes, they need to be pushing product because they have a business to run. They have a tour to plan. We need to have something out there for people. But I like to believe that they also feel like they have something new to say. And as scattershot as these last four albums are, I mean, let's be honest, X or 10 or whatever it's called, is probably the most insignificant album in their entire catalog. That would be the last one you would probably ever put on. It has the least interesting story. There's really nothing that you need to know about it. But it's not bad. And if you love Def Leppard, you just want more Def Leppard. So I think the same rules would apply to Cheap Trick or any other band. David Bowie. I mean, David Bowie is making, supposedly, his most vital work is his last album. And it captures, supposedly, the spirit of his artistry better than anything he had done for a long time. That's what people believe. So, I mean, look at Prince. Prince just died. He's put out millions of albums, and they're not all good, but they all matter, you know? They're all interesting. They all appease the people who love him. So yes, is the spark gone about a band who's trying to change the rules or play by their own rules? Yeah, that probably is done. That's a natural part of evolution. It happens to every band. But bless them for still being a force in the world that can provide joy and bring joy to the people who love them. That's my feeling on it.
Yeah, no, I'm glad. I wanted to hear your take. See, I'm not saying that Def Leppard should stop, and I'm not saying that I don't like that Def Leppard still exists, but I'm just saying in theory,
yes.
Now that we're coming to this point in the history of rock and roll where, for one thing, we're not getting any new rock and roll, especially in America. No, you don't have any new rock bands. So for people who are fans of rock and roll, mostly what we have left are the old bands,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's true.
And so, I mean, we're at a point in history this has never happened before. You know, rock and roll in the scheme of things really isn't that old. So now you have this dynamic where you have these bands that they're still going. And whenever they come up with a new record, it seems like some of them are trying so hard to recapture what they did in the past, yeah. And they can never do it. I don't really know where I'm trying to go with this, because I like I said, I don't mean that Def Leppard shouldn't still be Def Leppard.
Of course.
But there is this idea that at some point, is it a rock band anymore, or is it just a corporation? And
it's a corporation. To me, it's a corporation that produces a pretty decent product, and I don't mind consuming that product periodically, like a candy bar or a cheeseburger. Or a can of soda, you know?
Yeah. my opinion of the album X is it's almost completely worthless, and there's almost nothing that I like about it.
Yeah.
The only song that I can remotely tolerate is You're So Beautiful, and I don't really think that's any good.
Interesting.
but a lot of X is like trying to be Nelly Furtado or something. It's really confusing.
Wow.
It's the production is... thinking back to 2002, I mean, what was the most popular stuff then? Were they trying to fit in with just mainstream? It's always weird to me that a band like Def Leppard thinks, well, Def Leppard's going to come out and just fit in with Nelly Furtado, but that's not how it's going to work.
Right,
it's not going to work that way.
I know.
Has that ever happened where a band like Def Leppard has come out with something that managed to be like a mainstream contemporary hit? It doesn't really work that way.
No, not really. Especially
well, I guess Bon Jovi kind of pulled it off with It's My Life.
That's true. Yeah.
But that was a Max Martin song, who you mentioned earlier. So.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I don't know. I do think that there are... That bands... And Def Leppard's guilty of this, too, when we talk about Sparkle Lounge. It's really popular now for a lot of rock bands to appeal to the country artist and genre. And so there, I do think, you know, look at Darius Rucker of Hootie and the Blowfish. He goes a completely different way, and the country world embraces him, and now he's as vital as he ever was, just without the Blowfish, in a completely different genre. And so I guess that can kind of happen. You could sort of, you know, cross over into a different genre. But if Def Leppard is still expecting to have songs being played on top 40 radio, those days are probably over. And I'll say, I'm sure we'll talk more about it later, but I think that's a shame, because their new album, especially from last year, has a lot of really solid stuff on it, and that is radio friendly to me. And so it's unfortunate that they just won't get the chance, you know? Before we move off X, I got to put a plug in for, I think my favorite song on that album is Love Don't Lie. But having said that, I realized it's because they are just bulletproof chords. Anyone playing those chords in that order, and we've heard it before, would make a killer song, and they do it, and they do it well.
Really, if you look at this, they went from Adrenalized to Slang to Euphoria to X. That's just, what are they? They're just trying everything at some point, you know?
Right.
None of those records have any kind of, like you said the word progression earlier. Well,
right.
This is like zigzag. It's just really a really odd sequence of albums that they had there.
It totally is. I agree. But then they kind of revitalized themselves with Yeah, don't you think?
Well, that became like a fad to do the covers thing. Yeah. And yeah was fun. And, you know, they had a lot of fun celebrating a lot of their glam rock favorites and stuff. And I admit I was collecting the different, you know, there was different songs on every, like, Best Buy and Target. Uh-huh. And I don't know. Uh-huh. There's a whole, like, separate album's worth of songs you can collect from all the different sources where they had you could get two tracks from here and two tracks from there. Yeah,
cool. Okay.
For me, my take on covers is if you're not taking a song that doesn't really sound like a Def Leppard song and making it a Def Leppard song and making it something new that you can appreciate as a separate entity, then I don't really understand the point of recording covers. If you're just going to do a straight-up cover to try to make it sound like the original, I understand doing that live, but I don't understand recording it in the studio or why anyone would want to listen to it. It's never really worked for me. I don't, you know.
Yeah.
Unless it's like a completely unknown song that you... If it's an unknown song you're exposing to a new audience, or if it's a song that is in a different style that you're kind of recreating in your own style... Those are covers I understand, but taking a song everybody knows and just trying to record a version of it that sounds like the original seems pretty pointless to me.
Yeah, I agree with you. I do think cover albums are kind of a cool little curio a lot of the time. That doesn't mean they're the ones you go back to. They're sort of, it's like the deleted scenes on a DVD, or you might watch it once or twice. And there's very little on Yeah that improves or even alters from the original versions very much. But I do think for them, I mean, we talk about, you know, being revitalized and the zigzagging of their career and their albums. I do think that Yeah is kind of, because it came on the heels, if I remember right, of the Rock of Ages greatest hits, which went platinum. Nothing had been platinum for a long time for them. Their greatest hits album comes out and goes platinum. They probably feel empowered to do something that for themselves. And that's what, Yeah, I think turned out to be. I like that record. I don't pop it on all the time. And some of them are so rote. I mean, we do not need another 20th Century Boy remake. Placebo already did that and did it better than this. But there are a couple songs on there. I really love their version of Little Bit of Love. And I really love their version of Step On. I think those are the two on there that I think, I don't know if it's improve upon, but they make an interesting enough version independently of the originals that they're worth listening to and kind of playing on repeat and going back to. Those are the two strongest to me.
I would say, Yeah, it was really fun for the band. It was fun for the fans. So there's nothing wrong with that.
True.
But
okay.
Yeah, it's not something that I'm ever going to probably listen to again in my life, I wouldn't think, you know.
Right.
But yeah, like you mentioned, nothing had gone platinum in a while. Yeah, X didn't even go gold.
No. Uh-huh.
At least Slang and Euphoria both went gold. But X.
Oh, did they? Okay.
Yeah, but X didn't even make it to that. So, and I would say deservedly so.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So yeah. Then it took how many years? Like 6 years before they did another studio album? Something like that with songs from the Sparkle Lounge, which there's a couple of songs in there that I like, at least. Yeah. So
that one, I would say that would be their second least inconsequential album behind X. Now, having said that, I don't think it's a bad album at all. I've had it for a long time, ever since it came out, and I listened to it a couple of times back then, and I thought, this isn't very good, and I put it away and haven't touched it for a long time. But then getting ready to talk to you, I've been spinning it a lot, and it's actually pretty good. There's some decent songs on there. There's nothing on it that is remotely as, like, you know, shuddering as X is. So by that measure, it's a better album. But it's not bad. It's okay. It's fun. There is that Tim McGraw country attempt at crossover on there, which I think is a little weird, but a lot of people are doing that. I don't necessarily want Def Leppard to do that, but they did, and I can't blame them. It's okay. But there's some good stuff on there. I really like Only the Good Die Young, and Tomorrow is a decent track. So there's some good ones.
I would, in my opinion, Nine Lives with Tim McGraw, definitely the low point of their entire career.
Oh, really?
Worse than Let's Get Rocked. Well, yeah, that might be saying so.
Wow.
I might have to put the song on, which I don't think I could stomach, but I've already said Let's Get Rocked is the worst thing they ever did, but
yeah.
I don't know. The Tim McGraw thing might be worse. Yeah, you said Tomorrow.
Tim McGraw than you are at anything on X.
Definitely. The Tim McGraw thing is unforgivable, in my opinion.
Shots fired. That's cool, though. I'm glad. I like those kind of opinions. Good one.
No, they're trying to do contemporary country, you know, fuck off with that. Right. Get away.
I'm not a fan either. I love how ballsy you are about this. Great. Good.
Yeah, you mentioned Tomorrow. My two favorites are Tomorrow and Hallucinate, which both were just written by Phil Collin. But I like those two songs quite a bit. That's what was different about Sparkle Lounge, is that a lot of the songs weren't a group effort. They were just like one or two names wrote them. I mean, they sold this concept that they wrote it all in the dressing room on tour. But then you look at the songwriting credits, and they're all just one name. So were they all just off in separate corners of the dressing room writing by themselves? Because it doesn't seem like it was as much of a group effort as they sort of tried to say it was when they were kind of marketing it.
Right. And I got to say, I mean, again, love Def Leppard, but to me, their sound, even if they say that it's, even when they're trying to be stripped down, their sound sounds a little fussy to me, a little processed. You can hear the flourishes on Joe's voice, on the guitars. There's, you know, some reverb or some echo here or whatever. None of it sounds straightforward, stripped down ever. And that gloss, I would say, think is almost their trademark. Unfortunately for you, who loves those first two albums so much, they have become known more for that glossy rock that Mutt Lange influenced, I'm sure. And that's been their, that's what they have. That's been their Trojan horse ever since. One of these times, I wouldn't mind if they made like a big FU album, and it was just them, you know, jamming no overdubs, acoustic guitars if they want, a garage rock record that's not fussy. I'm not even saying it would be good. I just think it would be an interesting exercise for them to do.
But going back to the talk about should a band exist after 40 years, I mean, because the essence of a rock and roll band is those kids in that rehearsal room, you know, with cigarette burns on the carpet and, you know, just the mishmash of wires they're standing on top of and just having so much fun creating music, not even thinking about who the audience is going to be or how many records they're going to sell. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you're never going to be able to recapture that because that's just a moment in time. It's never going to be the same, and it's naive to ever think it would be. So.
Right.
The heat goes up as the lights go down. The beat goes on when we hit your town.
So that brings us to their newest album, their self-titled record. Talking about the first song on the new album, Let's Go, mm-hmm. I wanted to see if you knew what I was talking about. There's this new thing in pop music, like this staccato, like stutter-type melody that they do in this song, which just kind of made me nauseous. The first time I remember it was like Wrecking Ball, you know, where she says, "Rat-a-a-act me," you know? And now I hear it in every pop song. They do that. I don't know what word, how you would describe it, but you know what I'm talking about? Like that stutter thing?
That stutter, yeah.
It seems like the new big thing in pop music is to do that in every song. And so they do it in this song, and I didn't like that when I heard it. Because I felt like they were going for that. I don't know if they were.
Yeah, they probably... Well,
but I felt like they were, and that bugged me, because it annoys the shit out of me that... Because I hear it in every song now. I mean, like, I like the song Wrecking Ball, so I'm not saying it's a terrible thing. But whenever I hear a new pop single and I hear them doing that, I just kind of laugh, because I know... Because they all have to do it now. I mean, I don't know what any other examples would be, but I know I've heard a lot of, like, recent pop singles where they all have to do that. However you would describe it.
It probably is a modern trick. It's funny. I didn't even notice, but maybe I... the thing that stuck out to me is that it feels Let's Go in a lot of ways like a Pour Some Sugar on Me rewrite. You just invert, you know, switch some chords around. But I was reading... It was probably on Wikipedia, honestly. I was reading that was sort of the point that they were sort of... restating that we are a band and we have a history and we want to call upon that history with our latest single, remind you of what we've done in the past, but bring it into the present. Apparently that's why the album is self-titled, which is a big sticking point. I hate when bands name albums after themselves or after a song on the album. It drives me crazy. That's apparently the meaning or the reason for Let's Go. But I think it's a great song. In fact, I love the first like 8 songs on this album, and I'm chomping at the bit to talk to you about Man Enough. So when you're ready, let's talk about Man Enough.
Oh boy.
Yeah, because I have a feeling, okay, bring your Man Enough hate. I know it's coming.
Yeah, no, I think it's terrible.
Oh, I love it. Oh man. It is so good. Okay, so I know, I feel like I'm talking too much here. Forgive me if that's what it is.
No, please.
Okay. See, okay, Man Enough to me feels like the risk that we have been waiting for them to take for four or five albums now. Mad Enough, which is a disco song. There is nothing Def Leppard about that. When I was talking earlier about how you could play something as radio ready, I would love somebody to play Mad Enough in a club and not tell anyone who it is. You could even strip the vocals out of there and it would get people moving. I think it is genius. I love that they had the balls to do this. But I thought people like BJ, who are still jonesing for High and Dry, are going to hate this stuff. But it is so good.
Yeah, no, as soon as that song starts, I'm just like,
oh, I love
skip.
It. No, that funky bass is so good.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of really anything on this album. I agree. Man. Let's go is okay, but when it gets I know it's just a personal issue I have with that. I think they were trying to do that kind of stutter melody. Maybe they weren't even consciously trying to do that, but I think Dangerous is an all right song.
Like I said, the first eight tracks I think are great. All Time High is, I think, could be like a new anthem for them. I think that is a soaring, empowering, positive. I love that song. I even like the ballad, which I'm not always a ballad guy, but We Belong is a very decent ballad. I could play those first eight tracks on repeat very happily and probably never get into the second half of the album, but it's too bad. It is, to me, their best album since Hysteria, for sure. It's a good one.
I definitely like Slang and Euphoria more, I would say. But we'll see. You love the first eight songs. Probably my favorite song is the second to last song, Wings of an Angel.
Yeah.
Either that or Dangerous. Those would be the two that I like. Really, the only two that I really like a whole lot on it.
Okay. This is fun. I love getting into it with you, man, and disagreeing on this. especially this, I feel passionate about Man Enough. That's a great one.
Well, I mean, sometimes I start analyzing my own taste and wondering what different motivations I have. Like, yes. if this record came out in the 80s, would I have a different opinion of it? Or if right. sometimes I think if songs that I love from when I was a kid, if they came out now, if I heard them for the first time now, would I even like it now? So, you know, it's hard to know what shapes what you like, but
I know.
I definitely went into this record hoping it would be good. I heard people tell me it was good. I didn't put it on with some cynical attitude waiting to hate it, even though I was like, please no auto-tune. But but yeah, it's just, yeah. I don't really care much about it. I'm never really going to listen to it, you know?
See, this is the one I might put on. So let me ask you this. Man Enough, if you heard that and you didn't know it was Def Leppard, let's say it's Prince or somebody funkier or whatever, do you think you could appreciate it or admire it for its own merits? Or does the sound of it, no matter what, just rub you the wrong way? And the fact that it's a band you love doing this drive you even more nuts?
I just don't think I would like the song or the melody that much, no matter who it was, probably. But
okay. That's fair, then. That's fair.
But it's not like I was expecting much from Def Leppard at this point.
Yeah, true. Okay.
I'm trying to think if I like any of these records more than Adrenalize. Because I was going to say, I think the three most recent albums are probably my three least favorite. But then I'm trying to, because at least there's a couple songs on it. I love Stand Up, Kick, Love, and The Motion. So just that alone kind of.
Sure.
Because I like that song way more than anything on any of their recent records. But yeah. So their recent output for me is pretty useless. In the end, there's a couple of songs I like, I'm never really going to listen to them. So
very true. Very true. I do think you could cobble together a decent, like, 20 song mix, the best of these four albums, but you're right. Is anyone going to go back and play these over some of those other ones? No way. But again, going back, I'm still grateful Def Leppard's out there doing their thing. If this is what it takes to keep them vital, you know, keeps them out there, with a reason to perform and play shows and make some money. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, yeah, they're a corporation, but we want our favorite artists to be successful, don't we?
So, yeah, definitely. I'm not,
you know, so bless them for it.
Yeah, no, I don't hold it against them to make a living, of course. Okay. But I don't know if I really articulated what I was trying to say well enough about. Should a rock band exist for 40 years? Does that even work just in the essence of what a rock band is?
Yeah.
Cause we're just at a weird stage in rock history, I guess.
Yeah, we sure are. So, very true. Well, cool. This was fun. Thanks for letting me do this.
Thank you. Thank you for doing it. Do you want to talk about any of the interviews you have coming up? Of course, this isn't even going to be online for 2 months, but
yeah, true. There are two coming up in the next couple of weeks that I'm pretty excited about. One of them, so do you remember I think you do. I think you're even friends with her. Do you remember the singer from the 80s, Fiona?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. I have her records.
I'm interviewing her next week.
Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah. And then I don't know if you'll think this is cool or not, but this I think is really cool. I'm interviewing George Winston.
Oh, do you know who George Winston is? Is he a jazz guy?
Well, he's like a new age piano player.
I know the name. Yeah.
Okay. So I love George Winston. I'm not crazy about new age music, but to me, that's not what he is. And he's put out several albums, some of which are like there's one called December. There's one called Summer. There's one called Spring, I think, or Autumn into Spring into Summer. Anyway, they're all these seasonal albums. It's a very left of center interview for me. But I love it because it's something different. And he's, to me, I've loved him for years, and he's a very mysterious creature. I don't know that I even know what his speaking voice sounds like. So I'm kind of looking forward to that, something different, you know? I don't know if your listeners will care at all about somebody like George Winston, but it's exciting to me.
Yeah, well, that's why you do the show, right?
That's true, yeah. I mean, if you don't like it, go get your own podcast, right?
Yeah. All right, well, thank you very much, John. Thank you for indulging me.
Thank you.
And you call me Beej. That's what Chris always calls me.
I just realized as it came out, I said it because he said it.
Yeah.
All right, so there you have it. What did we just do? 8 episodes about Def Leppard. Please let me know, rockandorrollpodcast@gmail.com, rockandorrollpodcast.blogspot.com. Hopefully you're part of the Facebook page. Let me know if you enjoyed 8 straight episodes, 2 months of Def Leppard talk. I'll probably do more series like this in the future. Not sure who might be coming up. If you have any suggestions, let me know. I have a couple ideas, but we'll see what happens. Next week is going to be a very cool episode I recorded with Chris Gray. If you remember my radio station compilations episode. Next week, Chris Gray and I each picked 12 songs from various artists' compilations, mostly from the late 70s, early 80s, lots of power pop, punk, AOR, metal. So lots of very obscure songs, nothing you've probably really ever heard before, but great songs. So next week, check out the various artists episode. Then after that, gonna delve into the 60s for a few episodes, and then maybe we'll start another series up soon after that, I'm not sure. But anyways, I hope you enjoyed the series on Def Leppard. I know I had a lot of fun recording all of these episodes with all of my great guests. I want to thank all of my guests who helped me out with these episodes. Joe Royland, Julian Gill, Greg Renoff, Joey Haney, Eric Miller, Pat Francis, Randy W. Hall, and John Lamoureux. Thank you very much, guys, for helping me out, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I really enjoyed it, and I think it went really well, and hopefully everybody listening also had a good time delving deep into the catalog of Def Leppard. That last song that we just heard, It's All About Believing, that's one of, I think, 3 new songs that they included on a 2011 live album called Mirror Ball. And so now that we've come to the end of the Def Leppard series, I wasn't really sure what to play here at the end, but I decided let's go all the way back to the beginning. And now, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
So what we're going to hear now at the end of the Def Leppard series is their entire first EP, called the Def Leppard EP. 3-song EP that came out, I think, in January of 1979. They recorded it in 1978. So when they recorded this, they were all teenagers. And this is one of the first new wave of British heavy metal recordings out there. So this is the Def Leppard EP on their own label, Bludgeon Rafola, 1979. It's Ride Into the Sun, Get Your Rocks Off, and The Overture. Till next time. I'm ready.
Man, just say to me, a beacon of light to see you through. For time is on our side. For time is the essence.
Be back.